This is your last chance to enter the Ohio Lottery's Fun Turns 50 promotion. Score $3,500 and two tickets to the epic party at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, where you could win part of another $400,000 in cash prizes. Enter the new 50th anniversary scratch-off or $50 worth of eligible non-winning $5 or $10 scratch-offs and My Lotto rewards through the Ohio Lottery app. Hurry up! The last entry deadline is May 13th. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, welcome to New Books in Buddhist Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm Luke Thompson, host of the channel. Today I'll be speaking with Stephen Kemper about his recent book, Rescued from the Nation, Anagarika Dharmapala and the Buddhist World, published by the University of Chicago Press in 2015. This book is part of the University of Chicago Press's Buddhism and Modernity series, edited by Donald Lopez. In this monograph, Stephen Kemper examines the Sinhala layman Anagarika Dharmapala and argues that this figure has been misunderstood by both Sinhala nationalists, who have appropriated him for their own political ends, and scholars, who have portrayed Dharmapala primarily as a social reformer and a Sinhala chauvinist. Making extensive use of the Journal of the Mahabodhi Society, effectively a forum for the expression of Dharmapala's own opinions, and the entirety of Dharmapala's meticulous diaries, which cover a 40-year period, Kemper asserts that Dharmapala was above all a religious seeker, a world renouncer who at times sought to emulate the life of the Buddha. Central to Kemper's study of Dharmapala are the diametrically opposed themes of universalism and nationalism. While Dharmapala was realistic insofar as he understood that the various Buddhist sects and orders could not be united due to sectarian, ethnic, and caste and class-related divisions, his Buddhist identity was in no way based on his own Sinhala identity, and his life was organized around three universalisms: an Asian Buddhist universalism, the universalism of theosophy, and the universalism of the British Imperium. He spent much of his adult life living outside of Sri Lanka and at various times imagined and hoped to be reborn in India, Japan, Switzerland, and England. Dharmapala devoted much of his life to establishing Buddhist control of the Mahabodhi Temple in Bodhgaya, India, which had been the legal property of a Shaivite monastic order since the early 18th century and had since come to be thoroughly incorporated into a Hindu pilgrimage route. His interest in the temple was in part a result of his own efforts to follow in the footsteps of the Buddha, but was also his attempt to establish a geographical point of focus for Buddhists, a Buddhist Mecca, if you will, around which Buddhists could rally and come together. He looked at many sources of potential support, including the Bengali elite, Japan, the Thai royal family, and British government officials in India, but in the end failed to achieve his aim. In contrast to previous depictions of Dharmapala as a Protestant Buddhist who encouraged the laicization of Buddhism, Kemper shows that Dharmapala was, if anything, an ascetic at heart, who believed celibacy was a prerequisite for soteriological progress and participation in Buddhist work, who emphasized meditation, and whose spiritual aspirations are visible from a very early age. Kemper also shows that the influence of theosophy on Dharmapala's interpretation of Buddhism and thought more broadly did not end with his formal break with the American Colonel Olcott and the Theosophical Society in 1905, but continued to the end of his life, a fact obscured by Sinhala nationalistic portrayals of him. At some 500 pages, Rescued from the Nation includes detailed discussions of many contemporaneous figures, movements, and trends. These include Japanese institutional interest in India, Japanese nationalism and the struggles of Japanese Buddhism in the aftermath of the Meiji Restoration, the World Parliament of Religions that took place in Chicago in 1893 and the emergence of the category of world religion, the Bengali Renaissance and associated figures such as Swami Vivekananda, Western interest in Buddhism and Indian religion, and South Asian resistance to British colonial governance. In this way, the book will be of great value to those interested in Asian religions and modernity, Buddhist and Hindu revival movements, Asian nationalisms, and Asia during the late 19th and early 20th centuries. I hope you enjoy the interview. Hello, listeners, and welcome back to New Books in Buddhist Studies. Today I'm with Stephen Kemper, and we're going to be discussing his recent book, Rescued from the Nation, Anagarika, Dharmapala, and the Buddhist World, published by the University of Chicago Press in 2015. Stephen Kemper is Charles A. Dana Professor of Anthropology in the Department of Anthropology at Bates College. His previous research has focused on, among other things, the construction of Buddhist and national identity in Sri Lanka and the advertising industry in Sri Lanka and Malaysia. Stephen Kemper, welcome to the show, and thanks so much for taking the time to speak with me today. So I was wondering if you could just begin the interview by telling us a very little bit about yourself, where you're from, and how you came to anthropology and the study of Sri Lanka, Buddhism, and religion.
Yeah, happy to do so. I grew up in Indiana. I came to New England to go to college, went back to the Midwest to go to graduate school at Chicago, got a job in the state of Maine, and I've been here ever since. I started out in college working on classics and English, wasn't terribly good at it, but was enthusiastic about it. But I had misgivings about matters that you might call epistemological. I didn't see it quite that way at the time. Mm-hmm. I just didn't understand the standards of judgment. So I became an anthropologist on the rebound. I thought anthropology was the zone of fact and empiricism and straightforward. I know better now, and in effect, I got what I wanted by backing into it. I became an interpretive anthropologist by the people I met and the course I pursued. But I didn't become an anthropologist straight away. It would have been hard for me to have imagined when I started college my doing what I'm doing now.
Hmm. And what about Sri Lanka? How did you come to the study of Sri Lanka?
I went to graduate school. I knew I was interested in India. I took Indian Civ with McKim Marriott, saw his black and white slides of Kishangari on the North Indian Plain, and I thought, I'm not sure I can do that. And Sri Lanka looked awfully green and benign. And then I met Mel Spiro, who was a wonderful guy who had who worked in Burma, but had experience of Sri Lanka, and I thought I'd work with him. But he left Chicago and went to start the Department of Anthropology at La Jolla. So then I gravitated toward Nyiralman, and I've been doing Sri Lanka ever since.
Hmm. So how did you come to focus specifically on Anagarika Dharmapala? And I should mention for listeners unfamiliar with this figure that Dharmapala was a Sri Lankan layman who was a champion of Buddhism and spent much of his life in India and England, spreading the Buddhist word and also attempting to establish Buddhist control of the Mahabodhi Temple in Bodhgaya in northern India. And his dates are 1864 to 1933.
That too had a roundabout course. I was asked to give a paper at a conference at Boston University on Dharmapala, and I wrote the paper, used the usual sources. Then I realized that there were two great resources that nobody had really fully exploited. The first is the Journal of the Mahabodhi Society, which was Dharmapala's mouthpiece for almost the duration of his life, from the 1890s until he dies in 1933. And what I eventually discovered is he had notebooks. Everybody knew he had notebooks, but it wasn't clear to me as a Sri Lankanist that they were easily accessible. And when I started out doing field work, and I saw people, Michael Roberts and Tessa Bartholomew's and Gananath Obeyesekara, making reference to the notebooks, and it occurred to me nobody has ever looked at the entirety of these notebooks. So I went to Japan on the way to Sri Lanka. I met a Sri Lankan Buddhist monk in Japan who had recently been elected the president of the Mahabodhi Society, and he let me have access to the diaries. Many people have had access to the diaries, as it turns out, but I sat in the Dharmapala Trust Library, and I photographed those diaries, and I burned up a little digital camera doing so, because there are 36 volumes, 400 pages per volume, TypeScript, foolscap size pages, and I was at a point in my career where I was willing to put the immense amount of time into exploiting this resource, which if I had been your age and looking for a job or looking for tenure, I certainly wouldn't have had time to do it. But at my age, I did have time to do it. So I got enthusiastic about a big-time commitment to Dharmapala simply by virtue of having something that no one had ever decided to exploit before, which is the diaries and the journal.
Yes. And you quote very extensively from the diaries in the book.
I do. It took me 5 years to read the diaries and to index the diaries. So I have a lifetime of material about Dharmapala, and that's what drives me into Dharmapala. It's having seen a part of his life that no one else had ever bothered to take a look at.
Mm-hmm. Great. So, in the introduction of the book, you emphasize the themes of universalism and nationalism, and these are themes that recur throughout the book, or particularly universalism, which is very central to this monograph. And you situate these themes in the context of the late 19th and early 20th century, noting how these ideas were central to the reconceptualization of Buddhism and other religions during this period. Would you briefly sort of just, we're going to get into this more later on in the interview, but would you just briefly discuss sort of why these themes of universalism and nationalism are important in your work, and perhaps in the context of previous scholarship on Dharmapala?
Absolutely. Dharmapala, I think, in almost every account has been understood as a Buddhist reformer and an ethnic chauvinist. He tied Sinhala ethnicity to the religion, and he revived both of them in the late 19th century. And people who've tried to understand the guy have understood him in the context of the process by which Sri Lanka became independent, the process by which Sri Lankans who had become Christians returned to their Buddhist origins, and an entirely Sri Lankan context. Reading the diaries, I realized that he spent something on the order of 80 to 90% of his adult life living outside of Sri Lanka. And the diaries gave me a day-by-day account of what he did outside of Sri Lanka. So the universalism theme was pertinent to his historical moment. There was certainly a huge amount of that around in the late 19th century, whether it's the International Postal Union, or whether it's the all the things that Leila Gandhi talks about in effective communities. There was an interest in that paralleled and encountered the rise of nationalism in the late 19th century, and I thought that Dharmapala was going to have a career as a universalist once he got to Calcutta, where he left Sri Lanka in 1889 on a trip to Japan, He came back. He then made a later trip after the annual meetings of the Theosophical Society. I'll talk more about it in a minute. Mm-hmm. And then he made his way to Bodh Gaya, which is the place of the Buddha's enlightenment. He didn't stay in Bodh Gaya very long. He moved to Calcutta, and he set up housekeeping in Calcutta, and he received the support of the Bengali Bhadralok, namely well-to-do people in Bengal who were also members of the Theosophical Society. I should say about the Theosophical Society that it's a Western movement led by a woman named Madame Blavatsky, who was a Russian aristocrat who made her way to England and eventually to New York City, where she met an equally anomalous character, namely Henry Steele Olcott, who had been an American Civil War officer. And they started this society. She was the ideological, the source of ideology, the mythopoetic genius. He was the organizational person, and he had real organizational skills. And Blavatsky less than Olcott. Olcott was a universalist, and Dharmapala became his assistant. When Olcott and Blavatsky went to Sri Lanka in 1880 to help rescue Buddhism, Dharmapala was a young boy. He was, at that point, 16 years old, but he became a member of the Theosophical Society because his father and his uncle and a number of people he knew were members. And he served as Olcott's translator. And he followed in Olcott's footsteps. Olcott was a wonderful human being who looked at Asians and saw fellow human beings, which wasn't a turn of mind that there was very little of in Colombo in the late 19th century. And so he became a firm friend of a whole set of people who were interested in the revival of Buddhism, and the idea of universal brotherhood comes from Olcott. It was more important for Olcott than it was for Dharmapala. So the theme of universalism versus nationalism, as I wrote the book, I discovered there was less universalism on Dharmapala's side than I had imagined. Mm-hmm. But that certainly is the intellectual context, and it's not that he didn't have a global career and that he wasn't interested in making contact with the Japanese and the Burmese and whatever other Asians he could hook up with, but Olcott wanted to create a Buddhism, not only a brotherhood of Buddhists, but an institutional Buddhism that would provide strength for the Japanese to fight back against Christian missionary effort, and likewise for the Burmese and for Buddhists all over Asia. Dharmapala, I think what you can say about Dharmapala is either he had less interest in creating a unitary Buddhism, or he had more realism with regards to how difficult that would be mm-hmm. to do. And part of that realism, I think, comes from his having grown up in Sri Lanka mm-hmm. and known what Olcott couldn't quite get his mind around, which was the social distance between the Kandyan monks of the Siam Nikaya and the Low Country monks of the other two Nikayas. The
Nikayas here being monastic orders.
These are monastic communities, ordination lineages, and they're the Amarapura and the Ramanya Nikaya, The Ramanya Nikaya is a single Nikaya, but the Amarapura monks have broken into 25 different subgroups, and the Siam monks have their sub Nikayas as well. So, and many of them, not all of them, but I would say 80% of those different Nikayas are recruited on the basis of caste.
Mm-hmm.
So Olcott thought that that could be overcome. Dharmapala, I suspect, did not think that was realistic. And it may have been that experience that made Dharmapala less interested in creating a unitary Buddhism across Asia,
mm-hmm.
Because he knew it was unrealistic, even in a local context,
yes.
like Sri Lanka. And once he got to Japan, he, and saw the various sectarian forms of Japanese Buddhism, once he had his encounter with Kokuchukai, which is the Japanese Nichirenist religion that he ran into in 1902, I think he knew full well that it mm-hmm. wasn't likely that the Japanese were going to throw their lot in with either the Mahabodhi Society, with Dharmapala, or with however you want to call it, Theravada Buddhism.
Right. Great. So I'd like to ask you a bit more about the influence of the Theosophical Society on Dharmapala's thinking. But before that, I just wanted to, because for people who have read previous or at least English language scholarship on Dharmapala, many of those people will associate him with Protestant Buddhism. And you argue that he, in fact, sort of wasn't a, you seem to argue that he wasn't exactly a Protestant Buddhist. So I was wondering if you could just briefly address that point.
Yeah, I'm not sure I can do it briefly.
Well,
I'll do it happily and as briefly as possible. The guiding idea for the study of Buddhist modernity in Sri Lanka is Protestant Buddhism. It's an idea that comes originally from Gananatha Obeyesekara, and it's picked up by Obeyesekara and Richard Gombrich in their book Buddhism Transformed, and it's the notion that in the reforms that Olcott put in motion and Dharmapala continued, there was an attempt to create a kind of laicized Buddhism with lay people leading the way and a kind of egalitarianism that looks like Protestantism and a kind of a concern for everyday religious behavior that has a kind of Protestant rationality, mm-hmm. if you believe Max Weber, as well. And my response to that is Buddhism has become laicized. Lay people have, whether it's Sri Lanka, Burma, Thailand, Cambodia, lay people have taken on unprecedented roles, but that wasn't what Dharmapala had in mind. Mm-hmm. So my book is an attempt to try to make an argument about what he did have in mind, in spite of the fact that Obeyesekara is entirely right about lay people coming to the fore. That goes without argument.
Mm-hmm.
But Dharmapala understood the religious life as depending upon celibacy. And I would say, if you want the key to my argument, it is taking seriously Dharmapala's own self-understanding. And that self-understanding is that of a man who didn't see himself primarily as a social reformer. He saw himself as a world renouncer, like many other South Asians who think that celibacy is the key to spiritual progress. He saw all sasana work, that is all Buddhist religious work, as requiring celibacy.
Mm.
So he didn't want lay people coming to the fore. He wanted people like himself coming to the fore. He was a brahmacharya. He wanted to create a brahmacharya order or an anagarika order, and he had hoped that those people would lead the reformation of Buddhism, and they would all be celibate. So he didn't have it in mind that pious lay people would play the role that, in fact, they've taken on.
Mm-hmm. So that actually leads to another question I had, which was that in the last 10 pages of Chapter 1, you discussed Dharmapala's views of marriage, spiritual companionship, and celibacy, and you write that Dharmapala's interest in spiritual companionship complicates his role as either a brahmacharya or a Protestant Buddhist, but it fits nicely with the turn of the century world he inhabited. So I was wondering if you could just talk a bit more about his views concerning these matters. And the ways in which he himself struggled. You mentioned this incident in Japan, for example.
Right. Dharmapala has been, in an early argument, Obia Sacra takes Dharmapala to be a homosexual. Mm-hmm. Dharmapala is not a homosexual. He struggles with his heterosexual urges throughout his life. And he never breaks his vow of celibacy, but he has some kind of encounter in a Japanese bathhouse, in a ryokan, where he's served by a Japanese woman. She bends over. I think he sees her breast. He's aroused, and he feels self-loathing for the rest of his days because of that. It may have been more than that, but it was certainly not sexual intercourse. So what I think is the great misunderstanding of this man is that Obia Sacra and Gombrich take him as a man who wears white. He wore white robes, distinctive white robes, when he went to the World Parliament of Religions in 1893. Mm-hmm. But by 1895, he was wearing ochre. He took the vow of Brahmacharya, and he saw himself following the Bodhisattva path. Mm-hmm. His father put him on the Bodhisattva path by having him on for a full moon day, Bodhisattva vows, that was his self understanding. He had it in mind that he would replicate the life of the Buddha, mm-hmm. and his going to Bodh Gaya is not simply social activism trying to reclaim a place that had fallen into alien hands. It was also his following out the Buddha's course. Dharmapala, the Buddha says, "I will stay here at the on the Diamond Throne until I achieve enlightenment." And Dharmapala says, when he gets to Bodh Gaya, "I will stay here until I recover Bodh Gaya from the Shaivites who control it presently." Mm-hmm. He wore ochre. He found lithographs of the Buddha. And his robes, which are not monastic robes, but tied in a distinctive way, were copied from the lithographs of the Buddha that he found. And he constantly projects his life course, and he wants his ministry to last 45 years. Mm. Well, we know where he got that idea.
Right.
He's imitating the life of the Buddha. He wants to be reborn on the Buddha Jayanti in 1956, so he will be able to receive the warrant from the Buddha who was thought to return on that occasion, the same way the historical Buddha got the warrant from the Buddha Dipankara to become the next Buddha. So Dharmapala didn't. I mean, this sounds hugely hyperbolic and. In a way it is, but he wants to imitate the Buddha, perfect his virtues, and then over a reasonable number of lifetimes, maybe seven lifetimes, let's say, rise to a state that would resemble the last life of the Theravada Siddhartha Buddha, so it's not arrogant, it's not presumptuous, it is simply high-minded and fixed on the idea that nirvana is a realistic, if not proximate, goal. Yeah. In the Theravada world, in Sri Lanka in particular, Buddhist monks don't think that nirvana is a possibility. And so Dharmapala didn't think it was going to happen in with Zen-like speed, but he thought that he could could and he should begin the struggle for nirvana as a realistic goal.
Okay, so going from his sort of that sort of idea that he was imitating Buddha, just going back to the Theosophical Society for a second. One of the things that you argue in your book is that the influence of the Theosophical Society and Theosophical thought on Dharmapala was much more influential, was much more extensive than previous scholarship has allowed, and previous scholarship often sort of marking 1905 as his sort of break with theosophy. I was just wondering if you could mention why previous scholarship has sort of downplayed or intentionally, unintentionally ignored this influence of theosophy. And also, this might be a good time to just mention where Dharmapala got his understanding of Buddhism from.
Well, he gets it from Western scholarships. He taught himself Pali, and I think he was reasonably facile in reading Pali, but he surely didn't have anything resembling a monastic education, and so he's dependent upon the early Western publications, and above all, it's the Edwin Arnold poem, The Light of Asia, that gets him going, as it got so many other Asians going about the extraordinary personality of the Buddha and the achievement of the Buddha. Dharmapala was a man who read Light of Asia. He didn't have... He knew that Bodh Gaya was a real place. There are lots of Japanese sources that say that the Japanese of the period thought that Bodh Gaya was in the Pure Land and it was a mythological place and not a real place. But Dharmapala is emboldened. He is invigorated by his trip to Bodh Gaya because even though it's fallen into this extraordinary condition where it's held by a group of Das Nami world renouncers who are Shaivites, it's the very place where the Buddha had his enlightenment, and Dharmapala is invigorated by that idea, and it sets off to try to recover the place because it makes no sense to him that it should be held by people who are not themselves Buddhist.
So, now in chapter two, you focus on Dharmapala's relationship with and experiences in Japan. He made four trips to Japan in 1889, 1893, 1902, and 1913. But besides those trips, he also had a relationship with Japan through some monks at Bodh Gaya, through his interactions with Japanese at the World Parliament of Religions in 1893 in Chicago. So could you just discuss his views of Japan, for sort of his view that it could served as a model for, while it had developed quite rapidly economically as a Buddhist nation that had, as he saw it, preserved its Asian civilization?
Right. This is complicated. He had a very high opinion of Japan, and well, he might have, but he saw in Japan what he wanted to see in Japan, and given the Meiji Reformation and the way the Japanese went crazy for Western values, Western dress, Western cuisine, the whole schmear of Western practices, he had to overlook that, and he had to overlook the fact that Japanese monks married. He had, and since he understands the spiritual life as requiring celibacy, that was a problem. Mm-hmm. And he was thoroughly uncomfortable with the amount of alcohol that Japanese lay people and Japanese monks drank on ritual occasions. So what he saw in Japan, in spite of all of that, was an Asian society that had held on to its distinctive identity. And I'm sure visiting Japan in the late 19th century and onwards, it didn't feel like a British colony. It was distinctive. And you know, the revival of Buddhism, which happens in late Meiji, that would have invigorated him. And he was the son of a well-to-do family in Colombo, a Buddhist family, despite the fact that he was sent to Christian schools to be educated. And his father was in the furniture business. So when he got to Japan, he was eager in pursuing a number of commercial possibilities. And his brothers came to Japan to pursue those possibilities. His father's firm started to import rickshaws. All of the rickshaws that were on the streets of Colombo when I first got to Sri Lanka, those are rickshaws imported from Japan.
Wow.
There were, I think, two major purveyors, but one of the agency houses that sold Japanese rickshaws was Don Carolus and Sons, which was Dharmapala's father's firm. And his brother went into the match business, importing matches from Japan. So he's a religious reformer. He's a sannyasin, but he's not averse to taking on commercial activities, because he knows he has to support his own life, and he sees doing business in Japan as a way that he himself never does that, but he imagines doing that, and he sees Japan as this remarkable economic engine that was growing more and more prosperous, more and more industrialized, and he saw it as a alternative to the hegemony of the British Raj and the colonial control of the Sri Lankan economy. And he likewise does that in Calcutta, where the Japanese have connections to the local economy, and where they are envisioning a kind of relationship with India that the Dharmapala had in mind, namely, we are co-religionists and we are going to do business at the same time.
Mm. So, moving from Japan to Bengal to Calcutta, in a second, I want to turn to the Mahabodhi Temple in Bodh Gaya and Dharmapala's efforts to gain control of the temple. But I just want to first talk. I first wanted to ask if you could address his relationship with the Bengali elite in Calcutta, and specifically his relationship with Swami Vivekananda. I think he spent, I don't quite remember, but something like 3/4 of his life in Calcutta, when he presented his cause of gaining control of the Mahabodhi Temple to the Calcutta elite, to some of his supporters there, he seems to have stressed some of the congruities between Hinduism and Buddhism. And so I was wondering if you could just address his relationship with this elite and sort of his presentation of Buddhism in this context.
Surely. He he enters a world in Calcutta of theosophists, of well-to-do Bengalis who have an interest in Olcott's and Blavatsky's Theosophical Society. So he has a ready network of people. They're all Hindus. They're not Muslims. There's a small community of Buddhists in, well, there are two small communities of Buddhists in Calcutta at the time, the Chinese, who he totally ignored, and people from Chittagong, who are Arakanese, and who are themselves in the process of establishing a monkhood and building a temple. And Dharmapala has sporadic connections with the leader of those Arakanese Buddhists, but he casts his lot with the Bhadralok, and these are people who are Hindus. So his problem is to try to portray Buddhism in a way that makes sense to people who are otherwise committed, and in some ways, it's not as much of an intellectual task as it could have been. The Buddha was an Indian. The Buddha, no doubt, went if he had a descriptor for his religious identity. This is atavistic, but anachronistic rather. He would have called himself a Hindu and not a Buddhist.
Yeah.
But that term not being available at the time of the Buddha, he thought he had discovered a variant on the ongoing nature of Dharma that was the truth. But whether the very idea is anachronistic, whether it was a new religion, that's a historical misunderstanding.
Mm-hmm.
So he can present the Buddha as a true son of India, as someone who is borrowing or depending upon ideas that are characteristic of Hinduism, and that's plausible enough. But then there's the fact that Hinduism historically had reabsorbed the Buddha as a incarnation of Vishnu. So in a sense, Hinduism had already done the work for Dharmapala by making the Buddha a world historical figure, but a world historical figure under a Hindu aspect, and that was certainly Vivekananda's understanding. Vivekananda and Dharmapala met at the World Congress of Religions in Chicago.
And could you just give a one sentence explanation of who Vivekananda is for people who don't know?
Yeah, sure. Vivekananda is the student of another extraordinary personality, Ramakrishna, who started a movement in Bengal. Ramakrishna was a village Brahmin and illiterate, but hugely charismatic and imaginative. And Vivekananda was his student. Not nearly as imaginative. Well, imaginative enough, but not as perhaps as extravagant as Ramakrishna. But he's the first Hindu guru to come to the West. He preaches a kind of Hindu universalism, which is founded on the Vedas, and in the end, Hindu universalism becomes Vedantic Hinduism.
Yeah.
But he is the person who does in the West what Dharmapala did in the West, namely embody these faraway Asian traditions that some Westerners have an understanding of and an inclination toward. And the two of them fall in with a whole set of well-to-do ladies in New England, in Chicago, in Los Angeles, and they become the supporters of these two guys. I think, spends 5 years after the World Congress of Religions in the United States, and he propagates his distinctive view of Hinduism. Dharmapala returns home very quickly, and Vivekananda, I would say, of the contemporaneous accounts of the two men give the edge to Vivekananda as being the more persuasive. But they were both the stars of this occasion, mm-hmm. and they represent the bringing of the guru phenomenon to the West, and the bringing of Asian religions as something that one could pick up and practice in Western contexts.
Mm-hmm. Moving back to the Mahabodhi Temple in Bodh Gaya in Bihar, in the state of Bihar in India, you note that this was. Seems to, and correct me if I'm wrong, but this was came to be the central focus of Dharmapala's life, was the sort of regaining of Buddhist control over the Mahabodhi temple. So I was wondering if you could just, if you could just say when Dharmapala first visited Bodh Gaya in, was it 1891? When he first visited Bodh Gaya, what did he find? Who owned the temple at that time? What was the situation?
Sure.
And then also, if you could just talk more broadly about why this spot was so important for him. You already mentioned the way in which he was sort of emulating the life of the Buddha, but also in the larger context of sort of his aspirations for some sort of Buddhist universalism, even though he had his reservations
right.
about the possibility of unity, what function was the Mahabodhi Temple to play? Sorry, that's sort of two questions, and both slightly large questions, but maybe let's just begin with, I mean, what was the state of the Mahabodhi Temple when Dharmapala first visited?
That's a good place to begin. It was the British had renovated the place 10 years earlier, so the temple tower had been reconstituted. It had fallen into wreck and ruin. There was a Shaivite monastery nearby, and the Mahant, or the abbot of the Shaivite monastery, owned the temple. And he ran it as part of a larger temple complex centered on Gaya. So this is when Hindu pilgrims came to the place, there was a circuit that followed the imagined outline of a great cosmic body, the feet of which were found at Bodh Gaya. So people who were coming to do their ritual duty to their ancestors, to their fathers in particular, would come to Bodh Gaya as a place where you would offer pinda, where you would offer your respect to sacred places. And this being India, sacred space is sacred space. The Shaivites are there. Presumably, the best guess is that they were there from the late 1500s onwards. By 1727, they have a deed from the Mughal emperor. So they're in a very strong position. Dharmapala arrives, and he can't imagine that this dilapidated place can't be immediately returned to the Buddhists because it is the Holy of Holies. It's the place of enlightenment, and he has, I think this is fair to say, he has a world religion's view of Buddhism. That is, it is a exclusive community. It is an absolute commitment to one ism and to the exclusion of other isms. And India historically has been more eclectic. That's why a mosque gets built on the site of a Hindu temple. That's why Shaivites can take over a Buddhist place. This is sacred ground, and it can be mythologically reincorporated into the Hindu tradition, but it has an intrinsic kind of sacredness. And Dharmapala makes his argument for Bodh Gaya being a Buddhist place, one on the historical truth of the matter, which is, to the best of our knowledge, this is the place where of enlightenment, but also because he has a world religions kind of view of Buddhism, which is the Muslims have Mecca, the Christians have Jerusalem, the Buddhists have to have a sacred place. And it's going to be Bodh Gaya. Sarnath, he visited Sarnath first, the place where the Buddha preached his first sermon, and he ended up living at Sarnath and building a temple at Sarnath, and it became a much more effective place for him to do business. But his heart was with Bodh Gaya. He lost the last legal effort to recover the place in 1910, but he never got over the fact that the sacred Buddhist place was in the hands of Shaivites. The Shaivites were completely open-handed. They were happy to have Buddhist pilgrims come. There was a huge majority of Hindu pilgrims who came, but Tibetans came. Sri Lankans would come occasionally. People from Burma would come. The Minden Min, the Burmese emperor, had made a huge investment trying to refurbish Bodh Gaya. So the Burmese were invested in the place, and they pilgrims would have come from Burma to Bodh Gaya, but the numbers were 100-1 as to who the pilgrims were. Mm-hmm. But the Shaivites had no interest in excluding the Buddhists. But when Dharmapala got there, he had a real interest in excluding the Shaivites because of his particular understanding of religiosity and pilgrimage.
Mm-hmm. So, so at the end of Dharmapala's life, what was the situation with regards to the Mahabodhi Temple in terms of ownership?
By the middle 1920s, Dharmapala was in a very frail physical condition by then. But by the 1920s, the Indian National Congress made more and more concessions to the Buddhists, and they did so. I think in a fully generous spirit, Gandhi said, "As soon as India is independent, we'll be able to sort this out." And what he meant by sort it out is we'll give the Mahabodhi Temple back to the Buddhists. Mm-hmm. But in the 1920s, the compromise was there would be a committee of Hindus and Buddhists who would look after the place. They would be equally represented, and a government of official would have the deciding vote, and that would always give the Hindus the advantage. So the Buddhists were not interested in being subordinated, and the Dharmapala in particular wanted Bodh Gaya to be a Buddhist place, which is what it's become now.
Yeah.
By way of land reform in India, the Mahant has had his extravagant landholdings taken from him. He, a world renouncer, was one of the richest men in India and certainly one of the richest men in Bihar. He had 60,000 acres of land under cultivation and peasant farmers who sharecropped for him.
Mm-hmm.
So he was a very wealthy man, and he could hire the best attorneys to defend his rights. And above all, he had a deed, and the British were people who respected their rule of law. So even though their sympathies were strongly in favor of Buddhism, that is, they understood Bodh Gaya as a Buddhist place, but you can find official after official whose personal sympathies lie with Buddhism and not Hinduism.
Yeah.
It is a Protestant Catholic kind of invidious distinction.
Mm-hmm.
The Hindus have idols, but the Buddhists have images. they don't believe in darshan. They don't believe in the possibility that you can have a real life relationship with an idol. It's simply commemorative, and so there is a kind of Protestant Buddhism. It's the Buddhism that the British saw. Which had certain Protestant qualities that they found very attractive.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting. When I was reading it, I was curious, so I looked at the English language Wikipedia article on the Mahabodhi Temple to see what it would, if it said anything about the Shaivite temple, and I think it said absolutely nothing. I was a little shocked.
Right.
But
right.
I mean, I'd be interested to read the Hindi and Bengali sort of Wikipedia pages on it and see if it's different. But anyway. So we're getting a little close to the end. I wanted to say something. I wanted you to say something about the British Empire before we finish, though. Because in Chapter 5, in which you focus on this, you begin by reminding us of two universalisms around which Dharmapala's life revolved, that of Asian Buddhisms and another organized around the Theosophical Society. But you then draw our attention to a third type of universalism at play, and that is the universalism of the British Empire. So could you just discuss, please, how this universalism operated in Dharmapala's life, how it allowed him to move between different countries with relative ease, and the role of the concepts of class and civilization in Dharmapala's experience of the British Imperium? I also wondered if you could mention here about the fact that he tended to divide people in terms of... you seem to suggest that he sometimes divided people less in terms of ethnicities, rather than dividing, for example, Sinhalese from English, for example, he would divide people according to, whether they were sort of civilized or not, or whether they're
right.
of a
right.
particular class or not.
Yeah, I'll do the best I can. I never really fully responded to your question about why Dharmapala gets understood as a nationalist and nothing but, and maybe one way I can approach the universalism question is by going back to that and
sure.
then trying to handle 12 things at once. Dharmapala, it seems to me, is a man who is first and foremost a world renouncer. He, one of the things you learn from reading the diaries is he had a disabled leg, and he thought, He intended to become a Buddhist monk, but he had a disability, and that he thought would prohibit his being robed and eventually becoming a full-fledged monk. So if you start with the idea that he sees celibacy as the key to the religious life, and he sees himself as a brahmacharya, he moves around the world, and he's imitating the life of the Buddha. Which is to say, his gaze is fixed on salvation, but remember the Buddha, instead of actually realizing nirvana, stays behind for 45 years to share the Dhamma with others, and Dharmapala is motivated to regain Bodh Gaya and to spread Buddhism to the West and try to link together the various Buddhist countries, because he sees himself as acting on compassion. And that's an imitation of the Buddha, and that's a motivation for doing social reform. So he moves, I think you can get a better fix on him, too, by saying he's not a nationalist at home and a universalist abroad. What he is, first and foremost, is a world renouncer. He's that at home, and he is that abroad. And so he sees himself at a remove from all social identities. But that doesn't mean he doesn't honor that or those identities, or see himself as a participant in the British Raj. He's a subject. He's not a citizen, but he is. He's less of a nationalist than people make out, and he speaks of Swaraj, which is a resonant of phrase in South Asian studies because it's Gandhi's phrase. It means self-rule. What Gandhi wanted was self-rule. What Dharmapala wanted was self-rule. But it means two things at once for both of them. For Gandhi, it means independence. Actually, it comes to mean independence. For Dharmapala, it means home rule. Sri Lanka is part of the larger colonial system, whatever that might have become. But he understands Swaraj the same way Gandhi understands Swaraj, which is to say the self-discipline, self-control. And the stuff about civilization is predicated on this notion that there are civilized people in this world. Some of them are Sri Lankan and some of them are British, but they all tend to have the same social characteristics. They all tend to be well-to-do and English-speaking and disciplined in terms that Dharmapala would recognize. So he produces a list of rules called the Gihi Dinacharyava or the Gihi Vinaya, which are 200-plus rules for civilized behavior. He publishes that in his newspaper, Singala Baudia, which is read by people in village Sri Lanka, and he means it as a tool for refinement. It's sort of a Norbert Elias kind of primer for getting people who might blow their nose on their sleeve to act in a refined way. And Obiasekara and Gombrich take that as evidence of Protestantism. I take that as evidence of his wanting villagers to be more self-disciplined and more civilized, and the rules are the way that he can make it perfectly clear what villagers ought to be doing.
Yeah. And with regard to his attitude towards the British, it would seem that I was, you know, some of the things you talk about, like for example, his loyalty to the king, and his gratefulness to the English language also seemed to contradict the image of Dharmapala as a nationalist.
Yeah, I think in retrospect, he's been appropriated by the nation, and this is not a deep message, but I think it's clear all across the colonial world and in the late 19th and early 20th century that the people who were eventually to become nationalists saw themselves as part of the British Raj, and if the British had behaved themselves more appropriately, they probably could have held on to the British Empire for a long, long time. But whether it's Jallianwala Bagh and the massacre of Hindus, or whether it's the kinds of nastiness that Gandhi suffered. Those people were alienated from the British, and they gave up the hope for any kind of good feeling between the British and people in South Asia. And I would say for Dharmapala, less so. He wasn't a rabid nationalist. He wanted Sri Lankans. He wanted Sinhalas, that is the Buddhist majority in Sri Lanka, to be proud of who they were. He wanted people to wear national dress. He helped invent national dress. He wanted villagers to be civilized, but he was worried about them having fallen into lethargy and corruption by way of alcohol. With the Colombo elite, he was put off by their being deracinated, and so he wanted urban dwelling Sinhalas to become more Sinhala and more Buddhist, and he wanted villagers to become more active and more civilized.
Mm. Great. So that brings us close to the end. I do want to mention for listeners that this book is full of a lot of information. And you also, I mean, it's over, about 440 pages. And then in addition to that, there are two appendices, one on Dharmapala's diaries and the other that gives a chronology of Dharmapala's life. And for people interested in sort of the late 19th, early 20th century for Buddhist modernism and such, there are a lot of discussions. There are a lot of places where you go into great detail concerning the sort of historical context, quite separate from Dharmapala, of course, related, but even for readers who aren't necessarily interested in Dharmapala per se, there's a lot of very valuable work here. And I should also mention, anyone interested in the history of Bodh Gaya, there's a lot of this will be a very valuable read. So as a last question, I just wanted to ask if there's anything particular that you're working on now. I know this book was just published, so perhaps it's taken a rest for the time being, but
and no, I'm moving on. I'm interested in modern Buddhism, and I have been working at the British Library for the last 3 or 4 years trying to better understand how it is that two things happen that I think are constitutive of modern Buddhism. One is, how is it that Westerners come to become Buddhists? That's linked up with Dharmapala in a number of ways. He didn't convert very many people, but he worked in league with Dhammaloka, who was an Irish monk who became an Irishman who became a monk, and Ananda Metteya, the Englishman who became a Buddhist monk in Burma. They both became Buddhist monks in Burma. And I mentioned, on the one hand, in modernity as expressed by the fact that Westerners can imagine becoming either a monk or a Buddhist lay person, and choosing at the same historical moment to do something that's radical and traumatic, which is to give up your identity as a Christian or whatever you might be, and become a Buddhist at a time when Buddhism was alien and hard to imagine, I think, for most Americans. And I'm interested on the other side of it, which is, how is it that Buddhist lay people in Sri Lanka, as opposed to the traditional understanding of themselves as Dayakas, that is, as of people who lead the religious life by supporting monks, how do they come to be activists? How do they come to be laicized? How do they come to think that they can lead a fully spiritual life and take responsibility not only for their own salvation, but also for reforming their religion and modernizing their religion? So I want to think about how it is that Dharmapala, as an interstitial figure, gives rise to these two modernist turns. On the one hand, Westerners becoming monks, and on the other hand, Sri Lankan Dayakas becoming Buddhist lay people who think that they're an important part of the religion.
Great. Well, we'll look forward to future publications on those themes. But I just wanted to thank you again for speaking with me today, and also to thank our listeners for tuning in. That's it for today's New Books in Buddhist Studies. See you next time.